are in a series from the book of Genesis called Headwaters. Just like the headwaters of a creek starts up in the mountains and then flows down to form a large river and really determines the course and the flow and the content of the river, we're looking at Genesis as the headwaters of our faith. That really what we find in Genesis carries through all of Scripture. It's just not a unique historical reference, but what we find there about you, about life, about us, about sin, about grace and judgment, we find in Genesis, we find covering the entirety of Scripture. And with that, we do come to Genesis chapter 11 this morning. It's a very famous chapter, the chapter on the Tower of Babel. Let's stand and let's just, without any further delay, let's just get into that. And we're going to read verses 1 through 9 in preparation for our time this morning. Genesis 11, 1 through 9. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. It came about as they journeyed together that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people. And they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel. Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. You may be seated. So, just to kind of pick up again where we're currently at, is this is about 100 years, these events take place about 100 years after the flood, after the flood waters have subsided, about 100 years have gone on. We skip Genesis 10, we're not doing a section by section, verse by verse look at Genesis. What we're doing is we're covering those major themes that cover the book of Genesis as we look at the headwaters of our faith. But Genesis 10, just to, for information and context sake, Genesis 10 is a historical overview. It basically tracks the line of Noah's sons and their families and how humanity spread. It tracks the spread of humanity around the earth. And it does so apart from any moral or spiritual evaluation. It just says, this is what happened. This person had this person, had this person, and they went here and went there, and they settled here, there, and everywhere. And so it's just simply historical data. Now, there's significance to that that we won't get into. So I don't want you to think that it's scripture, but it's meaningless. No, it has a specific point. But here in Genesis 11, we see a very specific incident that within chapter 10 that is really I call it a divine catalyst. It's a divine catalyst. In chapter 10, it shows the people of the earth spreading out. Chapter 11 shows us why and how they spread out. That there was the divine catalyst, that God was the one that sent them around the earth, not just by way of command, which we've seen several times in the book of Genesis, but he actively stepped into human history and forced their expansion. It kind of reminds me of what we saw in the book of Acts. Remember that God told the disciples, "Be my witnesses, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost part of the earth." And what did the disciples do really well? They did Jerusalem really well. And they missed the Judea, Samaria, the uttermost part of the earth. So what did God do? God said, "You know, I'm going to allow the Jews who've crucified me, who've opposed me, I'm going to allow them, led by Saul, who would one day become the Apostle Paul, I'm going to allow them to persecute the church." And it was like playing billiards, where you've got the balls racked, and then you open the game with hitting the cue ball, and it causes all the other balls to scatter. That's what persecution did. It scattered believers around the earth because they weren't going. They were just hanging out right there in Jerusalem. Well, this is the divine catalyst of how God accomplished and spread people around the earth when he said, go and fill the earth. But it's not just a divine catalyst, it's a divine asterisk. Because it'd be easy to read chapter 10 and go, wow, humanity got it right. Noah got off the boat. God reaffirmed his blessing of being created in the image of God and saying, fill the earth. And look, the earth is being full, is being filled. They did it. Good for them. They got the message. No, it's an asterisk. It's an asterisk that in one sense kind of has a Barry Bonds feel to it. Barry Bonds set the home run record. There's an asterisk next to his name because he was full of chemicals and stuff that got him there. Right? It's like, okay, that really wasn't... We don't need to go any further. I will wax eloquent on that, probably because he was a San Francisco Giant, which makes it worse. But anyway, enough of that. The asterisk is that humanity didn't do that on their own. God had to force them into that place. He had to force them into that place. And what we see here in Genesis 11 also, it further develops the sinfulness of humanity because it's a societal rather than personal evil. What we've seen in Genesis up to this point, it's been focused on the individual sin of humanity, where the individual sin of individual people, and then even leading up to the ark in Genesis 6, it really talked about what everyone did, what was right in their own eyes type of feel. That was all really based on the individual. But here, we will see the collection, the society as a collective whole standing against God. It's the evil of society, and it really what we're going to see, and I'm amazed that I would miss this for so many years. The story of the Tower of Babel, we will see the foundation of the evil of our day. So much of what we see being played out in our world, it stems from what was going on back in Genesis 11. And as we see what was going on, as we see what God did, it's like, oh, right. It makes total sense. It makes total sense. Which, by the way, if you haven't done so already, I haven't. We all need to turn to Genesis chapter 11. And as we jump into the text, now that we have a little bit of context on Genesis 11 and where it plays out within the flow of Genesis, the first thing we're confronted with is human ambition. The human ambition. And the story is, as you know, the story goes, they came about as they journeyed east, verse 2. They found a plain in the land of Shinar. They settled there and they said, hey, let's make a tower. Now, I don't know if you've ever taught Sunday school before or if you're currently teaching Sunday school or you're teaching kids. So much has gone into, let's talk about this tower. And in the ruins in the area, it's what we would commonly refer to today as a ziggurat. And they're very common, and they're very religious in their orientation. And many curriculums have waxed eloquent about why they would build a tower. Were they building a tower to try to reach heaven, literally to get up into the heavens, to get to God? Were they building a tower so high that if God were to flood the earth again, they would be safe, they'd be safe from God? I want to encourage us and challenge us not to be distracted by the tower. Don't be distracted by the tower because it's not what the text is about. God isn't concerned with such trivial matters. The tower really is an incidental point of color, of filler, a point of context. It's like the illustration I like to give when we go through the book of Revelation. Don't be distracted by scorpions. Don't be distracted by the zombie apocalypse that comes from the east and overtakes the world. Don't be distracted trying to figure out who those are. Because if you do that first, you're going to miss the message. God isn't concerned that they built a tower. God's concern is with the desires and the motives of the heart. God's concern is with the desires of the heart, and that's really what we come face to face with here In chapter 11 of Genesis, the Tower of Babel isn't about a tower. It's about the drive and the impulses and the compulsions of the motives of these people's hearts. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, I just want to, you don't need to turn there. You can if you want to, but I just want to highlight this just very quickly. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5 says this. He says, and then Paul writes, "Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. And then each man's praise will come to him from God." And without going into a whole bunch of context there, the praise that's going to come from God is going to be about what drove what we did. What really was the motive and the attitude of our heart, and really our heart for Him. Proverbs chapter 16, Solomon writes this. Chapter 16, verse 5. I'm sorry, 16:2. Starting in verse 1, a little running start here. "The plans of the heart belong to the man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. All the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives." The Lord weighs the motives. It's the motives and the intentions and the desires of our heart that really that God is concerned with. Because if our attitude, our motivation, and our desires are truly seeking God and are in following God, then how it plays out is going to be good and shapeable and workable by God. We start with the heart and let it flow into action. Well, as we take a look at these people and what was going on, the thing that overtakes all of it is the ambition of the collective self. The ambition of the collective self. And what we see here is self-promotion and self-glorification. Look at the text. Look at verse 4. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." That verse right there, verse 4, captures everything we need to know about this story. It wasn't just they built a tower. Matter of fact, it wasn't just a tower they were building. They were building a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And their motivation was, let us make for ourselves a name. Let us make for ourselves a name. It's that self-promotion, that self-significance that they wanted, that they had to grab onto something for themselves. And really, if you want to tear apart the first 11 chapters of Genesis, that's what we see all along the way. What was Eve's issue? Do you remember? Remember in Genesis chapter 3 when the serpent came to Eve? Well, let's just look there. Genesis chapter 3. The serpent said to the woman, verse 4, "You surely will not die, for God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and it was a delight to the eyes, good for food for her, delight to her eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, to make her wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. In that moment, Eve's concern, it went from obeying God and living in a relationship with God to, what do I deserve? What do I want? And Satan was able to manipulate her and tempt her and twist her into thinking, God's withholding something from me. God is withholding what is best from me. He's holding something back for himself selfishly. And God's really to protect that. God lied to me. God said, if I eat of this fruit, I'm going to die. But this creature over here who really seems to know a lot and comes across really smooth says that's a lie, that we're not going to die. And you can kind of probably see the wheels turning in her head that we're God's special creation. He's not going to kill us. We're special. And yeah, and I should have that. I want to be wise. And suddenly it was all about self. Her self-glorification. Her self-fulfillment. And then Cain and Abel. What was Cain's worry about self? God rejected my offering. He accepted Abel's. I'm going to do away with Abel because God likes him more than me. I deserve to be honored. And so he killed Abel. Look at chapter 4 a little bit later on. Remember the story where, was it Lamech? Was it that was the gentleman's name? Yes. He brags about killing a man and killing a boy. And look how avenged I am. It was all about self-promotion and self-glorification. Look how awesome I am. Those are individuals, but collectively now, society was saying, we need to be something. We need to make a name for ourselves. To make a name has to do with making and establishing a reputation. They had the ambition of the collective self, of self-promotion and self-glorification. And because of that, their focus on self and wanting to glorify self and wanting to grab hold of self and our own glory and their own glory, what did it lead to? Look back at the text. Let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. That focus on self naturally turned into defiance to God. Because what had God commanded them? What did it say? God told them to fill the earth. To fill the earth. Verse 7 of chapter 9, after the floodwaters receded, as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. Populate the earth, not just one specific area. And so what they were saying was, if we don't take care of ourselves, we're going to end up spreading all over the earth. We will end up being at the mercy of God if we do not take care of our own glory. If we don't stand up for ourselves, if we don't stand up to God, we will be at His mercy. There's this weird, twisted, innate fear of what obedience to God will produce in our lives. You ever thought about that? How fearful we are of the consequences of obeying God. That if we obey, it's going to cost us something. And you know, we are no different than Eve. These people were no different than Eve. If I do what God wants, I'm going to miss out on something that I deserve. The ambition of defiance is powerful. It's powerful. And Peter talks about this and challenges believers. Again, you don't have to turn there if you want to, but in 1 Peter chapter 5, we are called to something different. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6 says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you. What's the anxiety he's talking about? Well, it's just following up a section, and it's several sections on submission. It talked about in chapter 2, it talked about submission to your government, submission to your boss at work, submission within your family. Wives, submit to the leadership of your husband. Husbands, submit yourself to the needs of your wife. In the picture there, his example is of Jesus. Jesus submitted himself to the Father to die on the cross to redeem us. It talks in chapter 4 about submitting yourself to persecution. Chapter 5, it talks about submitting yourself to the elders and leadership of the flock. What are we anxious about? What's the anxiety that Peter talks about there? It's the anxiety of being vindicated. Will I be exalted? Will I get my due? will I be vindicated for the person I am? If I submit myself, if I obey God and follow Him, will I get what is due me? And here's the answer. No, you will not get what's due you if you submit yourself to God. You will not get it at all. And we should be thankful for that, because what do we deserve? We deserve wrath. We deserve destruction. But if we submit to God, we humbly place ourselves before Him and we trust Him, we will be blessed and He will exalt us. He will vindicate us. He will glorify us. Go back to Genesis chapter 11. These people, as individuals leading up to this point, these people as a collective society, they did not trust God. And the glorification of self and the defiance of God is a powerful, powerful combination. Look back at the text in Genesis chapter 11. It says, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built, verse 5. And the Lord said in verse 6, behold, they are one people, they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. This is not talking about human ingenuity. This is not talking about God thwarting the development of technology, the development of culture and society. What the context is, there's nothing that will stop their sinfulness and their evil. Because they worship self. They actively, purposefully defy God. It wasn't even subtle like Eve, where she was manipulated, even though it was still sin. This is just an openly overt attack on God. God, we are not going to do what you want. Matter of fact, we're going to do everything we can to prevent ourselves from doing what you want. That is a powerful combination. And God says, if we don't step in, and notice the us. Several times in Genesis, it talks about us. It's the early indication of the Trinity, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. The Godhead said their evil is such that there is no evil that they won't do. Nothing will be impossible for them in their purposes. Self-driven society has no room for any glory other than its own. Intrinsic to the human story is mankind's innate desire for a godless, self-achieving glory. Look at Psalms chapter, the 10th Psalm, verses 3 and 4. And boy, do we not see that playing itself out in spades. Psalm 10, verse 3. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire, and the greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked in the haughtiness of his countenance does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. The wicked boasts of his heart's desire. You just have to take a quick look at the news. Take a quick look at the feed on your Facebook, your Instagram, whatever your media attachment is, whether it's in the e-form or it's still hard copy, we see this played out where the humanity proclaims and glories in its defiance to God. And you know, we get sucked into it as believers as well. We as a people, as the world, we glorify and promote self. Even within Christian circles, we are encouraged to discover ourselves, to find ourselves, to express ourself. And the best that we can be is to focus on self and who is self and how has God created self and who am I? Well, just without going into the psychology of it, without going into the foundational errors of most of that, just consider this. For us to be saved from our sin, what had to happen? Jesus had to empty himself. Jesus had to let go of self. You understand that? When we read, I'm going to read it because I don't want to do the Dan paraphrase. And this is in Philippians chapter Philippians chapter 2. Have this attitude, verse 5, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. He existed, he was God, but he did not regard his glory and his attributes as something to be held tightly to and clung to at the expense of his creation. He never quit being the Son of God. He never stopped being God. He never stopped being the second person of the Trinity. He just set aside his rights to proclaim that and utilize that so that he could humble himself and become a man and die for us. Self is so meaningless to God that God himself had to set aside who he was so that he could pay for our sin. It's humbling. But yet we still want to emphasize self. Well, thankfully, we get to see God's intervention here. Go back to Genesis chapter 11. And verse 5 really starts, really captures so much of it. Verse 5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. It's an ironic picture. Man wants to elevate himself. Man's doing the best he can do. Mankind as a whole, society, doing the best it can do to elevate himself. And it's the picture is God had to come down. And it's not that God wasn't there and that God had to arrive on the scene. It's written that way so we can understand it. But the picture is that God had to come down and to stoop down and to get really low and go, oh yeah, there they are. They wanted to glorify themselves, and their glory was such that for God, the picture is for God to notice them, he had to stoop as low as he could go. But it's also a fearful picture. Because what this says is that God sees, God knows, and God understands. God is not so big. He's not so mighty. He's not so distant in the heavens that he doesn't see and hear and understand what's going on in the mind and heart of people. He is that close. And that should be terrifying. That should be terrifying. And I admit, in times of emotion, where I'm frustrated, whether I'm frustrated with somebody or I'm frustrated with a situation, the words, generally speaking, do not come out of my mouth that would be offensive to anyone around me who's listening. But, oh boy, the words that go on inside of my head, as if that makes it okay. But I didn't say it. Yes, I did. I was screaming it loud and clear in my mind. And guess what? So often it's easy to think that because the words didn't come out of my mouth, that's hidden from God. Don't tell God. He doesn't even know. Nothing is hidden from the sight and mind and ears and understanding of God. It's a very, very fearful picture. But it also tells us that God is an active God. God's not passive. God just didn't create the world, pull it and get it started and let it spin like a top, and then sit back and go, all right, let's see how this plays out. Sometimes, and I may or may not have done this as a parent from time to time, where you go, ooh, I see where that's headed. Is anybody going to die? Are we going to have to go to the ER? I don't think so. I'm just going to kind of let this one go. I'm going to kind of sit back. I may pop some popcorn. I may get a soda and just enjoy the show. Yeah, I can tell by the look on people's faces that yes, that is a con. That, yes. And there are times where God does that. where he lets mankind go, but that's not the sole sum of existence of God, where he's entertained by the failings and sin of his people. God always has a sovereign hand and a control, and when things reach a point, he actively intervenes. You can always depend on God that when it is right, which goes back to earlier 1 Peter, in his time, God will vindicate you and exalt you. When the time is right, God will step in. See that from the Old Testament book of Habakkuk, where Habakkuk is going, God, hello, God, knock, knock, anybody home? McFly. Oh, wait, some of you are too young to know that movie. Sorry. And Habakkuk is crying out to God. God's going, no, no, I got this. I'm doing something that you have no clue of, and I was preparing it long before you thought it. God is active, always active in the affairs, not just of his people, but of his world. As we look at the world we live in, we look at the politics, we look at the terror, we look at the evil, and it's easy to go, God, where are you? God is active. God is doing things. God's doing things right now that we can't see, that won't bear fruit until he decides the time is right. And simply put, in this case, God, the active intervention of God was this. God judged their idolatrous defiance. Look back at the text. Verse 6, they all have the same language. Nothing they purpose to do will be impossible. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. God judged their idolatrous defiance. He brought chaos into their community. They had a solidarity in their sin. They had a solidarity where they were working together. They were a well-oiled machine working in defiance to God. God introduced chaos into their community. And he divided their unity and broke their solidarity just by confusing their languages. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. God turned mankind in that instance when he confused their languages and introduced all the languages of the world into these people. God, by effect, turned mankind against himself. Part of the judgment of God on sin was to allow mankind to turn upon itself. And you're like, how did mankind turn upon itself? Well, the united group of people here, what were they devoted to? What was their God? Self. Self-promotion. Making a name. Self-glorifying in defiance to God. Now, when God broke them up into groups and spread them around the world, do you think suddenly that was gone? Oh, absolutely not. Each group took their self-identity and their commitment to self and self-glorification and self-promotion and took them with them and settled it wherever they decided to settle. Why do we have a problem with nationalism and racism? Because we are committed to the glorification of self, my group, against that group. We're better than you. We're going to beat you down. We're going to enslave you. We're going to take control of you. Why do we have wars in our world? Nationalism. Our country's better than your country. We're going to dominate and we're going to control. God said, fine. You want that? Have at it. I'm not going to stop your self-glorifying life. I'm not going to stop how you play that out. I'm just going to let you suffer for it. I'm going to let you suffer for it. Remember how at the end of the story of the Noah's Ark, the waters receded, and God said, I'm going to give you a sign, the rainbow. See the rainbow, remember, I judge sin, but I'm at peace with you, and I will never ever judge sin that way again. The multiplicity of languages upon the face of the earth is a monument not to human ingenuity, but to human sin. When we look at the world and we hear all these languages that we don't understand, we are to be reminded the reason I can't talk to that person is because we're sinful and God judged us. The reason that cultures are in conflict with one another is because God judged sin. Do we need to celebrate culture? Yeah, that's fine. You have your culture. That's fantastic. Nothing wrong with culture in and of itself. Nothing wrong with your native language. Nothing wrong with that at all. Learn it. Live it. But just remember, the reason we are there is because God judged our sin. And the reason that our people groups and our cultures collide and clash and fight and try to dominate each other is because we are a sinful people. In God intervening, God accomplished His purpose. What was His purpose? Fill the earth. Fill the earth. And He did it in spite of human wickedness. And stop and think about that for a moment. How much of your life and my life we are frustrated and we're hurt and we feel that our life is completely short because of someone else's sin. And we go, if only. Guess what? Whatever has been done to you, whatever bad context you found yourself in, guess what? That cannot stop the work and blessing of God in your life. Think about this. God can even redeem your sin. God redeems my sin. And it's not like, it's like Paul said in Romans chapter 6. It's not that because grace abounds, we should just sin even more so that we receive more grace. No, it's just we should glory in the fact that God's grace redeems our sin. And God even takes our past and uses it and transforms it so we can have a test. We use it as a testimony. God will redeem our sin. God will redeem our lives. God will accomplish the purposes that He has set out for me and for you. And nothing can stop that. It might be painful. It might be grueling. It might be testing. But guess what? God is not going to be stopped. The best that humanity could throw when you had one world group of people working together against God, and God went, oh my, really? His will was done, and they were gone. And here's the thing, and this is a warning, should be a fearful warning to us. God gave them their heart's desire. What was their heart's desire? Let us make for ourselves a name. You want a name? Fantastic. They wanted a name. God gave them a name. Babel. It means confusion. It is not a complimentary name. Yeah, I'll humiliate myself. I deserve it. I heard the word frumpy used once, okay? In the context, Emily, you're getting this fearful look on your face. I heard it used in a way that I thought was rather cute and endearing. So I was young. I was ignorant. I really was well-meaning. I called my wife frumpy once. It did not work well. It really didn't. It's not a good name. Okay, just in case you didn't know that, calling any female frumpy just does not work. It's a name. It's just not a good one. These people, you're trying hard, Emily. You're trying so hard. I appreciate that. These people wanted a name. God goes, fine, I'll give you a name. I will give you a name. It's confusion. God, be careful what our heart's desire is, because God will give us our heart's desire. You look at Romans chapter 1, where people worship the creation rather than creator, and how that plays itself out in burning passions. And what does it say for several steps? So God gave them over to their lusts. They wanted to lust and burn in a way that was in opposition to God. God said, okay, is that what you want? You can have it. And then it just continues to go down. In the book of Deuteronomy is they're getting ready to enter in the promised land, and the second giving of the law for the people that were going to enter into the land. Moses tells the Israelites, do not serve the idols of the people that you're going in there to conquer. Do not serve them. And I'm going to give you the Dan paraphrase here. But if you want to serve them, oh, you'll get to serve them, okay? And what did God do when they went into the land and they didn't kick out the people of the land, they didn't cleanse the land, and they eventually became idolatrous and started taking on the idols of the people they were supposed to get rid of? What did they end up doing as a nation? They ended up being conquered and captured and subservient to those idols that God told them not to worship. God said, you want to worship those idols? All right, I'll make you worship those idols in a way that you don't want to. Be careful what you desire, because God will give you the desire of your heart. So where do these waters flow? As we track the headwaters of our faith, where do they flow? Well, first of all, mankind, we got to remember, mankind is fully and totally and completely depraved. Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitfully wicked. Who can know it? We are a depraved, sinful people. But remember this, God is sovereignly omnipotent. Our depravity, the depravity of our world, is not so powerful that it will ever get the upper hand on God. Not even close. And then really close to home, God does not tolerate the promotion of self. God will not tolerate it in my life, and God will not tolerate it in your life. But here's the glorious truth for all of this. The gospel redeems. You ever, we take glory and we get excited about the fact of what it says in Revelation. Revelation 5, verse 9 says, and they sang a new song, saying, worthy are you to take the book and to break its seals, for you were slain and purchased for God with your blood, men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Chapter 7, verse 9. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. And they cry out with a loud song, salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. The gospel redeems. Here's the thing. The significance of that people, tribe, and tongue. The book of Genesis starts out with the collective world here in chapter 11 being divided by their tongues and cultures because of their sinfulness. In eternity, God redeems all of those tongues, all of those tribes, all of those cultures, and He redeems them back into a united people of God. And redeems their solidarity in relationship to Him. And that's what the gospel does today. Not just in eternity. 1 Peter 2, verse 9 says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. A chosen race. For the people of God, there is no race except for the fact that we are God's people. We're not American, African, Asian. We are believers. That's our race. God saves us from a multiplicity of races and tongues and tribes from around the world, and we become the one new people of God. The gospel redeems. I want us to take a little bit of time to close out and pray. Because we can't leave this without spending some time between us and God. What is that situation right now where you're just like, God, I don't see your omnipotent power, your omnipotent sovereignty. And God, I'm struggling to trust because this situation, it looks unmanageable. It looks hopeless. Talk to God about that. Ask Him to help your faith. Because nothing is beyond the sovereign, omnipotent hand of God. But then also talk to Him about self. What is it about you that you're holding on to? God, I just can't let go of that. I can't open that up to you because, God, this is who I am. And if I let go of this part of my life, or if I submit this to you and go, God, do whatever you want with it, I'm going to lose. I'm going to miss out. You're going to take something from me. I'll never forget. This is so powerful in my life. I came to a point where I said that to God. I said, God, things are not right in my life. God, take it away. Take away those things in my life that need to be done away with. God, those things I'm holding on to over and above you. And I was dead serious. Within a matter of a few weeks, literally just a few weeks, two of my two closest friends, they got jobs in other states and moved away. A few months later, I got engaged to not Rainy. And I prayed the prayer again, God, there's things not right in my life. Take away what needs to be taken away. Things came up in my relationship with the girl I was engaged to, and my engagement was broken off. And I was like, I was devastated. My best friends were gone. My fiance's gone. Oh, wait, I prayed. And boy, that sure hurt like the dickens. And I've never felt more alone in my life. And guess what? I would not be here today without God taking those things out of my life. I have no idea where I would be. I had to trust Him. And God blessed. What is it? And just in case, just so you know, God did provide a wife for me. Just in case you didn't know that. That was like a huge fear when I grew up. I held on to that. So like, God, I need a wife. I need a wife. I need a wife. I need a wife. Okay, I'm going to take away the one you think is your wife. I'm going to take it away. Now what am I going to do? The only person in the world who will agree to marry me, and she's changed her mind. Well, actually, I helped her change her mind, but that's a whole different story. It was a good reason. Anyway, whatever. And guess what? God provided a wife. And God provided three kids I love dearly. And God provided me with three grandchildren. And God, the story goes on and on. What are you holding on to that you need to let go of? What's that situation where you need to submit to the sovereign, redemptive hand of the omnipotent God in your life? Let's go before the Lord. Spend a little bit of time talking to Him. Call out to Him. Confess to Him. And after a little bit, we'll sing some more. And I'll close in prayer.